The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. The cyberpunk author Rudy Rucker is the guest this week, and we discuss his recently published book, Journals, 1990 through 2014. Rudy Rucker is a writer and a mathematician who spent 20 years as a Silicon Valley computer scientist. He's a contemporary master of science fiction and received the Philip K. Dick Award twice. His 37 published books include novels and nonfiction books such as The Fourth Dimension. He composed Journals, 1990 through 2014, over 25 years. It's Wednesday, July 15th, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear Richard Sandling as he describes doing stand-up at a science fiction convention, a ukulele cover of the Star Trek theme, and Rudy Rucker describing his novel, Software. The music you're listening to now is Paradise 3001's Mondo 2000. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Rudy Rucker and I discuss writing through time. Rudy Rucker is a writer and a mathematician who worked for 20 years as a Silicon Valley computer science professor and published a number of software packages. A founder of the Cyberpunk School of Science Fiction, Rucker also writes science fiction in a realistic style known as transrealism. His 2006 book, Mathematicians in Love, was an example of a transreal novel, and his early cyberpunk four-book series was recently republished back in 2010 as the Ware Trilogy. Rudy Rucker? A tetralogy, you're right. Sorry about that. The Ware Tetralogy. I just somehow... It's written right there in front of me, but I didn't want to read Tetralogy for some reason. But, yeah, welcome back to my podcast, and welcome to Zero Squared.
Thanks, Doug. The fact that you do a podcast has been sort of an inspiration for me that I always wanted to get one together myself. So,
well, yeah, I was listening to your podcast and thought it was quite interesting. I've actually subscribed to the Rudy Rucker podcast and would recommend that to people who are listening to this podcast. So you've recently published a book just called Journals, right?
Right, Journals, 1990 to 2014. It spans 25 years.
And is this your most recent book?
Yes, it is. It's something, it came to exist because I've been keeping electronic journals ever since 1990. That was, you know, sort of when I got ramped up into the computer thing. And so I thought I'd always had in the back of my mind that I would make a book out of these journals. When I was young, I liked Camus' journals, and then I liked Kafka's journals, and I liked Andy Warhol's journals. And I thought it would be nice to have a book of my journals. And I also thought, since I have some time, I might as well do it myself as opposed to letting someone else do it. So it was a lot of words. It was more like 600,000 words. And usually a novel is like 100,000, so it was quite long. So then I went over it over the last, really, about 3 years. I went over it about four times. And then I'd get tired of it, and then I'd come back and go over it. And then I enlisted a couple of guys to proofread it. And then I cut it down to 400,000 words, and then I published it myself as a paperback, hardback, and ebook.
You've been self-publishing for a little while now. When did you start self-publishing your books?
I think it was around 2004, 2014 or 2013. It was when Turing and Burroughs came out. My main publisher was Tor Books, and I did about 8 books in a row with them, and I had a good relationship with them. But then there's this death spiral thing where the sales were going down, and they were getting less interested in doing it, and maybe, well, not that they ever promoted them. You as a Tor author know what that's like. But then, and David Hartwell, my editor there, was always very supportive, but, you know, it's not entirely his decision, of course. And then I did a novel, Jim and the Flims, and they didn't want to do that, so I took that over to Nightshade. And then Hartwell did pick up one more of my books. It was my autobiography, Nested Scrolls. And there was some hope that that might make it over to the mainstream, because it's, you know, a fairly interesting book about a writer's life. But it didn't catch on. And then at that point, Tor said, well, we just can't publish your books anymore. And I had thought I'd found a new home at Nightshade, but then they more or less went bankrupt, or they got bought out by somebody else. So then I thought, well, screw it. I think I can figure out how to publish myself. It's not that hard. I mean, it's hard in the sense that I was a computer science professor, and it took me 7 months to learn how to do it. So
yeah, right.
It's non-trivial, but I did figure it out. And then, so now I'm selling the paperbacks via Amazon and making my own ebooks too. And that's the downside is that I don't get much promo that way, but again, I wasn't getting much promo anyway. I guess the big thing is that you don't really get onto the shelves of bookstores, and in principle they can order them, but they won't do it, so that's kind of, and you don't get reviewed really. Maybe Locus will review them, and maybe a few scattered people review them. The other downside is you don't get a book advance, but the strategy that I figured out for that is I do a Kickstarter for each of my books, and that way I'm able to raise maybe $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000, and that's pretty much what I was getting as my advances towards the end at Tor, so that's okay. And the sales are less, but of course I get a lot more per unit than I would if it was being filtered through a publisher.
I have to talk a little shop with you, because, you know, I've worked with Tor and I've worked with Nightshade Books, both. And in fact, I have a novel coming out in August from Nightshade Books, and they're still going, and still a going concern. The Skyhorse is the new company that owns.
Right, they're an imprint of Skyhorse, yeah, and that's probably not so bad.
Yeah, I mean, would you, if they were interested, maybe I won't leave this in the podcast, but if they were interested in picking up one of your next books and would pay you a $5,000 advance, would you want to go with Nightshade through Skyhorse, or have you decided that overall you like self-publishing better?
Well, I don't think I would go with Nightshade Skyhorse. They're so small, they don't really, I don't know, they don't have much of a presence. And I had a lot of trouble getting paid for my Nightshade book. It took a long time. And, of course, they were in dire straits now, and probably with Skyhorse running the shop, it wouldn't be so hard now. There's also a question, would Skyhorse buy a book from me? And my books, aficionados of my work say, you know, I'm at the top of my form, and they're, you know, they're even better than they ever were. But for, like, a commercial bread-and-butter science fiction publisher, they're not really looking for literary, highbrow, esoteric, countercultural, bizarre novels, and this is what I tend to write, and you yourself do that to some extent.
What do you think about the trajectory, genre fiction and just fiction that has taken over the last 20 years or so? I mean, when you were writing and getting started and sort of forming cyberpunk, it seemed to me that, at least looking back, maybe I'm looking back through rose-colored lenses, but it seemed like there was a lot more of a market, a lot more people interested in complicated, forward-looking, sometimes experimental fiction. And, you know, the new wave had happened, and now there was cyberpunk. Where do you think Is that, am I looking back at it through rose-colored glasses, or have things changed?
To some extent, you are looking through rose-colored glasses, because the whole point of cyberpunk was a rebellion for the fact that the market was just full of bloated crap, you know, and the way it pretty much is now. It was, you know, that never changes, you know. People like these big fat series, you know, and they like fantasy. There's more fantasy than there used to be, but they like these epics, and they like having heroes who are in the Space Navy, and they're aristocrats, and it's just, you know, corny crap. And so there's always, that's always the lion's share of the market. And the people who read science fiction, well, if you go to cons, I don't know if you've ever gone to an SF con.
A few.
It's sort of a sobering experience, because you'll find that a lot of the people there aren't really people that you can imagine yourself writing for, though.
What's your favorite show? She said, I really like Star Trek. I said, trying to keep the mood going, not thinking. Oh, so you're a Trekkie. The whole room just went cold. She looked at me, no. I'm a Trekker. And I'm trying to think, what can it be? Maybe Trekkie is Kirk and Trekker's a Picard. You know, friends. I had to ask her, what's the difference? And she said, this is absolutely true. She said, Trekker is what people who like Star Trek call themselves. Trekkie is a derogatory term used to cause offence. Like Jew. Now, I'm wondering if I should point out that putting on pointy ears and hanging around in a motel in Bedford for a weekend and people think that's a bit silly is not as bad as the Holocaust.
One thing that's happened over the years is that there's been more fantasy. It's been sort of eating our lunch. And then the other thing that's just I've noticed in the last 5 to 10 years is mainstream is eating our lunch. I mean, like the New Yorker last week's New Yorker, like there's a story in there called, I think it's called Grow Light People. And it's a science fiction story, you know. And the front page of the New York Times Sunday book section, really, I would say one week out of two, well, maybe I'm exaggerating, but one out of every two novels, it seems like, is basically a science fiction novel. But they don't call it science fiction because I don't know. Well, science fiction, it's just saying this is for morons, you know. So, mm-hmm. But they call it speculative or futuristic or visionary. And it's become a way to write about the present, because the present, everybody has the sense that, you know, it's slipping away from us. William Gibson, of course, he's so great at turning these bon mots, these phrases, and he says, well, science fiction is his way of getting a little distance on the present, you know, just backing off just a little bit, and a way of trying to come to terms with it. And that's sort of what I'm doing with transrealism also, a way of just dialing up the weirdness of the present to 11, and then we're sort of able to notice more what we're actually doing. There's things we do that we're just like we're asleep. It's like we're sleepwalking. I mean, everybody you see is carrying a cell phone and looking at it, you know? And if you had done a jump cut from 19, I don't know, even from like from 2005 to now, it would like really freak you out to see that. But now, it's everybody's doing it. You know, it's always been this way. It's not surprising. And that's where, if you do science fiction and you do another jump cut, you know, where like maybe everybody's wearing Google Glass shades, you can't see their faces, something like that, it sort of snaps you out of your sort of trance, and you'll notice things. So,
right. So
that's, I mean, as a true blue science fiction writer, I have a lot of resentment and bitterness towards, like every writer, we're always resentful and bitter, you know, these newcomers are getting, you know, they're getting patted on the head, you know, the big critics, the mandarins, you know, they're totally accepting them. But, you know, I'm like the old style, you know, the the bad person who writes science fiction, and they're not going to even look at what I write.
Are these books coming out from the mainstream commercially viable books?
Who knows? Publishers, it's the thing like that that'll happen. They'll give somebody one shot. You know, it's like they're buying. Nobody knows. It's just, even editors have told me this. They just never really know. It's just so chaotic. It's just so chaotic in the mathematical, physical sense that it's really impossible. It's absolutely no way to predict what's going to catch on. And then, but they publish these books, and that's what people want to write these days, and people like reading them, and, you know, some of them do catch on. I mean, I think Jennifer Egan, her books have a science fictional quality, and that guy Steingart, Super Sad Love Story, that's a science fiction book, and and Updike wrote one or two, and the thing is, if you stay in the SF bin, maybe you're guaranteed of selling 2,000 copies, and if you go out in the mainstream, I think it's entirely possible that you might sell, you know, 200. I mean, people really take a bath there sometimes. But you seem to me actually like somebody who would have a chance of getting out of the SF category and being marketed as mainstream. I mean, you have that literary quality. I mean, is that something that you've thought about, how to do that?
Yeah, I definitely want to do that, but I don't. But we should be more. I should be more disciplined here and not let you get me into a conversation about my career. I want to talk to you. Maybe we can bring that up at the end. But I want to bring up something you just said about getting distance from the present and bringing it back finally to your book here. Your book of journal entries is interesting because it starts in 1990 when you were 44, which is a year. That's how old I am now, and. And then it ends in 2014, last year. If you were to look back to the age you were in, the age I was in 1990, which was 19, you would be looking back at 1965. So in 1990, you were 44. 1965 was the equivalent amount of space away, basically. It seems to me that the world changed a lot more from 1965 to 1990 than it did from 1990 to now or to last year. Am I, again, looking at the world through strange glasses? Have things changed more than I think, and it's only because I haven't taken that science fictional step back from the present that the changes don't seem as dramatic? What do you feel about the changes from 1965 to 1990?
I think in 1990, we barely had email. We barely had the web. It really had just started, and it was very hard to do that stuff. You needed a modem, you know, if you remember them. And they made that funny noise. And you weren't really browsing the web at all. So I think the internet is really, I guess that's the big story over the last 25 years. And the terrorism. But from 65 to 90, that's also quite a jump. It seems like that was maybe longer, but part of this is the way that the human mind works, which is that the first half of your life feels maybe five times as long as the second half of your life. You know, it's a sort of psychological phenomenon.
Right.
If things are new and you're being surprised. And I mean, the computers weren't there at all in 65, and they didn't, well, they really only started about 86, 87, you know, so.
Oh, well, that's not true. That's not true. They started in 79.
Well, they're starting and starting. I mean, in my life, I didn't own a computer, like a word processor, until, about 84.
Your book starts when you're 44, your kids are leaving home, you've already kind of established, would you say when your book starts you're well established as a successful cyberpunk author
yeah.
at that point?
Yeah, I was doing, that was actually almost a high point of my career, right around right around 90, 92, I was getting $20,000 advances. I was doing well.
Yeah. And you were working for Mondo 2000 at that time too, right?
Yeah, the Mondo story. Yeah, you had said you were curious about my exact role with Mondo. Working for them, that wouldn't be accurate. I knew them, and they actually, I was the person they got the whole idea of cyberpunk from. It was a word they'd vaguely heard it, but they didn't know what it was. And as soon as I got out here, I came out here in '86, and then Allison Kennedy and Are You Serious rented a space on San Pablo Avenue in Berkeley, and I went there and I gave a talk on cyberpunk, and they totally got off on it, because before that Mondo had mainly been about psychedelic drugs, and then they had this idea, this computer stuff, this is kind of sort of psychedelic because you're reaching outside of your mind, you know. And they liked to talk about hacking, but you know, none of them knew jack shit about using a computer. I mean, later they hired, you know, some graphic artists who knew a lot about it, but like Are You Serious and Allison, they, you know, zilch. So then, I mean, their idea of, you know, hacking would be to take, you know, like ecstasy or something and then imagine that you were doing telepathy with your friends, but it wasn't exactly assembly language, you know.
Yeah, right.
But so I kind of turned them on to that. And then they got me to do a few articles for them, not a large number, because it was frustrating to write for them. Allison, it's just hard to overstate what a marginal kind of personality she had. I mean, likable, and, you know, I enjoy it. She was exciting, but I'd send her an article, she'd lose it, okay. I'd send it again, she'd lose it. Then, you know, they were going to publish the issue in a week, and then she'd write me, well, this article, you know, you have to rewrite it, you know, there's something wrong with it, you know. And then I'd rewrite it, I'd send it, she'd lose that, you know. And then, you know, she'd say I was going to get paid, but she never paid me, you know. So it wasn't a market where I was, after a few times like that, I liked the glamour of being associated with them. They had great parties. They rented this wonderful old house in Berkeley, this enormous old craftsman-style house. And a lot of them lived in there. RU lived in there. Allison lived there. Heidi Foley, I think she was living in there. She was with Bart Nagel, who then started doing the art. And he was really the first person that was using graphic tools for a magazine. Everybody else was still doing Pace Up, and he was doing stuff like Quark and things like that. Yeah, so yeah. That was awesome. And my daughter Georgia actually went and became their intern. And Allison was very, very, very paranoid about the CIA, you know, as if the CIA would care about them. But but she liked the idea of hiring my daughter because she knew I was safe. I was a cyberpunk, you know, I think we had smoked pot together. So she figured my daughter wasn't going to be a spy, you know. And so, and that, then Georgia went on and her career ended up being a graphic designer. So it was a really valuable experience for her, and she enjoyed it too. Although, again, there was the same kinds of issues that I had where they'd finish an issue and then Allison would want to throw out the design. But over the years, I must have done 5 or 6 articles for them. And then the part where I became really sort of linked with them, they got, the magazine was sort of dying. What happened, Wired showed up and they were eating Mondo 2000's lunch. That's the second time I've used that expression, eating their lunch.
Yeah.
And because you couldn't really buy an ad in Mondo, because Allison, she had this alternate personality she'd put on. She called herself Al Ann Venable when she was being the advertising exec at Mondo. And then she'd always somehow end up starting an argument with the people who just wanted to buy an ad, you know. So,
oh, God.
And so Wired was just, you know, steamrollered them. And, but, you know, at the very start, there were similarities between them. You know, now Wired has kind of mutated into something a little less radical. But, the part where I finally really got linked with Mondo was they wanted to do a book called The Mondo 2000 User's Guide to the New Edge. And so Allison got quite a good contract for it with Harper Collins in, I think they were working out of San Francisco then. And then are you and her and Bart were going to put it together, and then they realized they just were unable to do that. That wasn't something in their skill set. The idea was to take material. By then they had, I don't know, 15 issues, and somebody had to go through the issues and take out articles and cook them down and put, you know, cool little, you know, full page, half page bits out of there. And then they said, well, we need a mathematical logician. Let's go to Rudy, because, you know, I have a PhD in mathematical logic.
Yeah.
And so then I knew how Allison acted. I knew she was not going to pay me whatever she promised me to pay me. So I sicked my agent on her and made her pay me in advance, which really pissed her off, you know. But she had
right.
she had gotten a $50,000 advance, and I wanted whatever. You know, I wanted 10 or 15, you know.
Yeah, right.
So then I did it, and it was fun doing it, and it was a very cool book, and it made the cover of Time magazine, which was just, that was insane. I mean, I felt like such a success. I'd brought cyberpunk to the West Coast, and we were on the fucking cover of Time, you know, and cyberpunk in big letters. They had a picture of one of the Mondo people there, Heidi Foley, and they interviewed me a little bit, and I said something like, I don't really like psychedelic drugs. And then my wife's father, you know, he fixated on that. He says, you don't really like them.
So, okay. So what year was it that that book made the cover of Time?
You could look it up in the journals. I would have to say maybe 92, maybe something like that.
Yeah. I mean, because, okay, first, you're talking to someone who probably first encountered your work in that magazine. Living in Portland, Oregon, you know, going to college off and on for way many, too many years, you know, never quite wanting to let go of being a university student and reading Mondo 2000. And, it's sort of shocking to me to realize that you were in your mid-40s at that time. How old was... Are You Serious and Allison? How old were they?
They're my age also, yeah.
Yeah. So you're, like, this was a kind of a carryover from this, in a way, from the 70s. I mean, like a hippie project.
Yeah, it was hippie. And then I went through sort of a punk phase more than the others. I'm the oldest cyberpunk. I'm older than Gibson, and he's older than Sterling. And then... Shirley, I think, is about the same age as Sterling.
Mm-hmm. And so, but you were defining the counterculture for at least the West Coast of the United States in the 90s. I mean, you and, for me anyway, for you and then Nirvana and Douglas Coupland's book, Generation X, and Richard Linklater, you're kind of all... of a piece in my mind, even though you're it's all completely different projects. Do you see that you were involved in sort of shaping the counterculture for a generation?
That's nice to hear you say that. I don't generally think of that as being the case, but yeah, cyberpunk really did catch on. The word, people really dug it. It's the reason it was such a powerful word is that it's a synthesis. You know, it takes cyber. Everybody, you know, can see the computers are taking over. People are being like machines. Machines are being like people. And then there's this redeeming thing that up until then, computers had always been boring. So things that are run by dweebs, some like yelling face on a giant screen on a wall, like in those crappy Hollywood movies. And our Star Wars, with everybody wearing these dumbass pajamas, you know, and English accents. And then, but we said, let's put punk on it. And let's have sex and drugs and rock and roll, and let's be countercultural, and let's have it be funky and street. And then people really got off on that, because then they said, well, this, we're about to have our souls stolen by the machine, but cyberpunk, if we come at it that way, then that's salvation.
So when I started writing, one of the things I wanted to do, I think, and I'm maybe expressing it for the first time now, is have that kind of impact where you get to at least partially define a moment. I mean, Mondo 2000 didn't define the generation the way Slacker did, or the way Generation X did, but it did define something, and it was sort of it was on the edge of all of that, it seemed to me. Did you have that ambition?
Oh, very much so. Where I was coming from, when I was in high school and in college, it was the Beats, the Beatniks. It was Kerouac, Ginsberg, Burroughs, and they were totally my heroes. And I dug that they knew each other, they hung out, and they changed the country. They changed people's way of seeing reality. And I always thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be like those guys. I want to have this thing. And I still can't believe that it worked out. It was really... I once asked Ginsberg, how did you guys get so much ink? And he just says, fine writing. So I wrote as hard as I could. And then Sterling, he really got the ball rolling, you know, and he latched onto my work, which, you know, appealed to him. And then, of course, Gibson, you know, was just this super bestseller. I've even worked out this analogy where Gibson was sort of like Kerouac. He was the writer who had huge, you know, huge sales. And then Sterling was more like Ginsberg in that he had this polemical side. And then Shirley was more like Gregory Corso, this, you know, completely whacked out, you know, enchanted person. And then my role would be Burroughs, because I was the professorial one, the oldest, the dry wit. That's me.
Yeah. You gave yourself the coolest one to be. Like saying, we're like the Beatles and I was John, is basically what you did there.
At that point, cyberpunk didn't exist. I first heard about it from Bruce, who he sent me he had this zine he called Cheap Truth, and he mailed that to me around 1981. And also he'd written reviews. By then I'd put out 3 science fiction novels, and nobody had reviewed them. Locus magazine didn't like them. The review just said, garbage in, garbage out. That was their review of software. So, they weren't ready, you know. They didn't know things were changing. And then Bruce and I, the first cyberpunk panel ever was, I think it was 1981, at the North American Science Fiction Convention in Austin. And Bruce and I were on the panel with John Shirley and Lou Scheiner. And for some reason, the moderator, unlike Henry Jenkins, was a raving jackal. It was like having George Goebbels be your moderator. He was the fans were pushing back. You know, they didn't want things to change. They wanted to wallow in their ermine epics, you know, and their castles and their space navy bullshit, you know. And they didn't want to hear sex and drugs and rock and roll and robots eating people's brains, you know, and good stuff, you know. So the raving jackal, you know, basically John Shirley got so mad he left the panel, you know, and then he talked Bruce, I think, into leaving the panel, but I stayed there because I'd flown a long way. So, so this is a more pleasant reception. So now we're just harmless old men.
In one of your journal entries, you talk about, very briefly, having been to see Dazed and Confused in 1993 and how people of your generation would probably really dislike that movie, Dazed and Confused, and that your wife disliked it.
Well, the people of my generation, well, the music, you know, it wasn't music that we were listening to a lot, you know, and but I liked, you know, the teenagers getting drunk and stoned. I mean, what's not to like about that, you know?
Right.
And I had some sort of evenings a little bit like that in high school, though we never had that much fun. You know, we didn't even have pot in high school, you know, but just driving around and looking for parties and beer. But yeah, that was a very cool movie. But it was the new generation, and it was interesting to see. I rewatched it not so long ago, and I found it really holds up. Movies like that don't always hold up, but I watched it about a year ago, and I really liked it.
So, okay, now a question formed in my head while we're discussing the way that you shaped and that the Beats shaped the counterculture. it seems to me that what the model has been is, in a way, is to change the way youth see the world. And that also that what's happened to you, and tell me if I'm wrong here, is that you've moved from being the kind of writer who aims at, you know, people in their 20s, in their teens, to being a more mature writer. That's that maybe the difference between cyberpunks and transrealism is the difference between in a level of maturity, at least partly.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm 69, so you want to get the, you know, the late work, the late style. And I had this turning point when I was 50. Before that, I was drinking and smoking pot, and then I stopped when I was 50. And that's maybe changed my personality, or to do that, I had to change my personality a little bit and be a little bit less enamored of shocking people, though I do like shocking people anyway. I mean, like, look at this thing with the UFO fucking the boy. But and maybe I'm still, you know, bitter and against the establishment. But there's something, I feel like I've gotten better at depicting people in an empathetic way. And the cyberpunk thing, you can't just keep writing that. I went back to it in my novel, Post Singular, and that was, I thought of that as a strong cyberpunk novel. Didn't really quite get recognized as that, but it did pretty well. That's one thing I've done with some of my books, just because I wanted to be read. I put Post Singular, and for that matter, the Ware Tetralogy, they're online as free Creative Commons books. And it seems that doesn't really cut down your sales as much as you might imagine that it would. That's Cory Doctorow's the great apostle of doing that. And it seems to have worked pretty well. So I like the cyberpunk thing. And you know, there's always, you know, I still have that basic bad attitude, you know, that sneering contempt for everything that we hold sacred. That's never going to go away. But I like to sort of tie it to my actual real life. Though there with transrealism, what happens, Updike sort of had this problem too. I mean, once you've written about a certain time period in your life, you don't really want to do it again. Maybe twice, but you know, you can't just do it over and over. I mean, some authors will do that. I mean, you don't want to endlessly write about your relationship with your father, you know, like novel after novel after novel, or your mother. And but I've sort of burned through most of my life in terms of transrealizing it. So now I'm actually closer to a traditional novelist in a realist novel, in that I will model my characters and scenes on things that I have encountered, but I won't necessarily specifically have it be at a certain stage of my life. Like Mathematicians in Love, it might be hard to point to a specific character and say that's Rudy. I mean, there's aspects of me in both of the protagonists, but it's not like in an earlier book of mine, like All the Visions, you know, where it's sort of, you know, a bildungsroman about me growing up in Louisville, Kentucky. Oh no, that was Secret of Life. Sorry.
But the question was that came to me here was, you know, is it possible to be the kind of novelist, specifically novelist, because that's what you and I do, that can change the way people see reality, but not just do it generationally? In other words, I think that when you're aiming at the youth counterculture, changing the way the world they see the world, it's almost like it's a niche market of its own, and that you're not going to have as profound of effect on the world as somebody who could come along and just dominate every market, you know, get the people in their 50s to be wowed and to rethink their position in the world because of a book. Is that possible? Am I just like, is this just a power fantasy I'm having here? Sounds like it. But what do you think about that aim?
Well, it is sort of a power fantasy, and it's better for me not to nurture that too much. It's the thing, like if you step up, baseball analogy, if you step up and you plan to hit a home run, you're going to swing too hard and you're going to strike out. So I thought David Eggers' book not so long ago, The Circle, that seemed to me like a book that could have a big effect on society, though. I don't know if it really caught on. It was, in a way, it was sort of making fun of Google. And I was at Google a month or two after that, giving a talk about something. And then I said, have any of you read The Circle? You know, and like nobody had read it, you know. They didn't want to read it.
You know, the other side of that question about could such a novel come along? I mean, I think of the only novel that I think that I can remember that kind of hit on that level and maybe had that kind of impact, but not as completely, would be Portnoy's Complaint, maybe, that came along and was on everyone's table and was sort of defining the moment for the adult population.
When I think about that book, he had such funny things in there. Well, the other thing, it's talking about writers' fantasies, is the one where the sort of afterlife fantasy, where when you die, you know, suddenly you're going to be like Raymond Chandler. They're going to excavate, you know, you're just stunning, you know, strangely neglected masterpieces. And but I've sort of let go of that one, too, because, well, mainly it's finally sank in that I'm really not going to be there to enjoy that if it happens, so...
Right.
It's sort of like, you know, somebody who's like very strictly religious and they say, well, I'm going to like flagellate myself every day so I can get into heaven. And then, you know, you die and whoops, there's no heaven. So
that's the same thing with posthumous fame.
Yeah, it's better to let go of these things if you can.
Damn it. All right. You know, you're a writer, and if you've given up on posthumous fame and you're not, if you're no longer aiming to, you know, make everyone into your zombie and change the world.
Why do I still write? Well, I write because I enjoy it. It's a craft that I've gotten good at I've been doing it for, well, I started when I was about 30, so I've been doing it nearly 40 years. And it's something, I'm like a weaver or a painter or a sculptor. I've gotten very skilled at doing this, and it's pleasing to me to exercise the skill. It's something it's what I do in my time. I don't have that much to do. I'm not raising children anymore. I don't have a job, and but I enjoy doing this. It satisfies me, and I know that I bring pleasure to a few, you know, there's a few aficionados that are going to appreciate it. And even in the background, there is this sneaking feeling that I'd like to leave this monument, you know, and it'll be there. And I get email, not every day, but certainly once or twice a week from somebody just who knows where, you know, anywhere in America or even somewhere else in Australia. And they'll just email me, well, I read such and such a book and I just loved it. And I'm going to read a lot of your work, and it's, you open my eyes to looking at things in a new way. And then, so it's, you know, saving the world one person at a time.
Well, any advice to me as someone who's pretty much standing exactly in the spot you were in terms of, you know, age anyway, as I go forward in the next 25 years?
Well, I think it's important in your novels to think about what people like. I used to resist doing this, but I try to always have a love story. It's just people want to have a love story. You know, they're together, they break up, they get back together. And your characters, you should have several characters, and they should have interior lives and be empathetic. And don't be afraid to try the crazy shit. I'm still always telling myself how to write. Just the other day I realized this routine I was telling you about the saucer laying the eggs on the ceiling of the car, I'd been thinking, oh, I'll do that halfway through the book, you know, I'll save it. And then I realized then I didn't know what to put in the next chapter. I didn't know what to put on the next page. And I realized you can't save up, you know, save up the goodies. You say, no, you can't see the fireworks yet. It's just keep on setting them off all the way through the book. And because, I'll get anxious that if I set off this great Roman candle that I have, then I won't have anything left. But if I just give, something more will come to me. And I'm a strong believer in the muse. It's a shorthand way of saying something, which is that a lot of my ideas, they don't come from a logical process. They're inspiration. And there's actually, if you get into the computer science and the mathematics, you can actually prove that it is, in fact, impossible to predict what you're going to do in a novel. There's just no way to get it by logic. And the only way it's going to come is by the churning of your mind day after day is going to then pop this thing up, and it'll feel like it came from the muse. And maybe there is, at some deeper level, we have a quantum entanglement with the world, and the cosmos is, when I'm really rocking on a book, I'll get this feeling like the world is dancing with me. I'll be thinking about a certain kind of character, and then I'll go outside, to the main street, and I'll see, the template for that character, and they'll be saying something, and it's just perfect what they're saying, and I'll jot it down. I often have a scrap of paper in my pocket, and I can jot things down. And that's another reason I like writing. It's not just the craft, I'm not like just some sweatshop worker. It's joyful. It gets me high. It raises my consciousness. So, just keep thinking about your readers and get high off your writing.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books Podcast.